When we think about the changes in expectations of leaders, there are a number of consequences with the shifts from 80 years ago. And these are the kind of shifts that people like you and me, who some of us have been in ministry a long time, we're growing aware of, we're trying to kind of make sense of, trying to make this kind of transformation. So 80 years ago, leadership was about heroic individuals, people that, you know, knew everything and would make everything happen and, you know, would resource everything. Churches today, they long for shared leadership. They long for opportunities to be involved. You might say, not in my church, they don't. But but there is that sense in which people want to feel that it's a shared leadership. It was fine in years gone by if the vicar was guarded, a little bit distant, you know, didn't give away too much of what he or she thought. That kept distance. That was okay. That was appropriate sort of professionalism. Things have moved significantly since those days. Vulnerability is a quality that is much appreciated, particularly as we think about working with younger adults too. Positional, we used to think, I think I've seen this in my 30-odd years of ministry. I think I used to have respect by virtue of the fact that I occupied the role of vicar in a community. I think that's now a very mixed thing. People are suspicious of positional authority, and therefore respect has to be earned rather than assumed. So that's a shift. I think also ministry used to revolve around tasks. You know, we're doing this fate, we're having this service, we're, you know, etc. We're doing this visit, etc., etc. There's a much stronger sense on building community, and I wonder if that's because actually we don't naturally have a sense of community in our communities, and so therefore people, when they come to a community of faith, are looking for that to develop. There's been a shift from directing towards empowering, and from aspirations to inspiration. I mean, generalizations are never totally the whole story, but these are some of the trends that have been a result of that. Any comments or observations on that?
Just a couple of comments. I think specifically, one of the differences in Wales as opposed to England, I think it's a sort of legacy of the chapels.
The chapels are, like ourselves, occupying, you know, marginalised, but still in the heads of people, this sort of chapel-church dichotomy is still significant. And that is quite a difference in parts of us from England. But I think the other major point is, I mean, I'm, you know, going back nearly 50 years since I was trained and ordained, and even then, the church seemed to be, you know, towards the margins. I see more towards the margins now. I mean, in terms of expectations, especially with the growth of the internet and social media. So you know, the kind of understanding of the place of the church and of the, you know, the vicar and the church community generally. I mean, is that much further, you know, away? So that we can't. A lot of assumptions, you know, are no longer shared or understood. And it's just the point about, you know, truth and what is. You know, what's Christian truth? I mean, his gain is just away from where people are. So it's a lot harder, actually.
Yeah, understood. My favourite story about chapels, I worked in Suffolk for a while, and chapels are really strong in East Anglia as well. But I had a curate who was visiting someone who he thought was unconscious and prayed with this man, and didn't know if the person, his eyes were open, but didn't know if he could hear anything. And so at the end of the prayer, he signed himself with a sign of the cross to make clear. He just said a prayer, at which point he sat up and said, "We'll have none of that. I'm chapel." So these things are very deep-seated. But anyway. So we've talked a bit about some of this stuff. Let me just mention a couple of book things. I mentioned a bit about this book. It was written really, although James Lawrence has put it together, this is kind of the shared wisdom of leaders throughout the UK at the moment. as to how, it's not an evangelistic resource, it's how do you move a non-mission-minded community towards mission and evangelism? What are some of the steps that you can take to do that? And the reason I've just put that up there is that a kind man thought this was such a key issue for the church. He said, well, I will pay for 3,000 of these to be produced if it's part of a learning community. And so we've sort of established a learning community around this book. Some people engage with it more than others. But that's the reason why it's for sale for £10. Or if you want it for free, you need to click the code and then I'll give you a copy for free because of the kind benefactor that wants to make it available. Right, two things I'd like us to do before we finish and move on to the next thing. One is to talk about this thing called adaptive leadership. Adaptive leadership is another one of those kind of buzzwords that's around at the moment, and it's related to the VUCA thing that we were talking about yesterday. It's not actually that radical in some ways, but people are thinking about what it looks like in today's generation. I mean, you and I know that our leadership has to adapt because we're called to proclaim the gospel afresh to each generation, and each generation has different features. So it may be that the gospel remains the same, Jesus remains the same, but the way that we communicate that will change. The FAOC report, which is the Faith and Order Commission, produced something about senior leadership, and they use the word faithful improvisation. They're looking for bishops and clergy to be people who are faithful to that which we have inherited, but capable of improvising the way that we communicate that. And obviously within the world of fresh expressions, church planting, missional communities as small groups planted out of churches, and missional areas such as Exeter Diocese, or the Church in Wales and other people, there's a whole lot of learning taking place about how leadership is adapting to our changing circumstances. And I wanted to sort of relate that to the period of COVID, where, again, buzzwords that have been around, flex, pivot, tack, you know, all organisations who are heading along have had to suddenly take a bit of a turn. One of the features of that is that we've learned to connect in different ways. I think the environmental stuff is challenging us to tack and flex and make changes. I think some of the political stuff is impacting that, and the cost of living is. So all of these different things. So I recently had a communication from the Diocese of Bristol, who are trying to put together warm spaces and trying to define certain churches that they'll set up as places where people can come and work and coffee is available. You know, that's an example of leadership thinking, how do we move in a certain direction that shows that we're alive to the challenges and opportunities of our times? And there are two books that I've read recently that I think are really helpful on this. One is How to Lead When You Don't Know Where You're Going. I think that's a great title. And early on during the pandemic, I got some of the larger church leaders, leaders of larger churches. we had a little Zoom conference. And I know this group quite well because we do something with them every 2 years. And they're all people who know everything about, you know, you just ask a question and they've got the answer. And we started talking about, okay, leading during this pandemic period. And there was deafening silence. And people saying, I don't know, you know. And people that kind of prided themselves in knowing stuff just didn't know. And there was something actually very healthy about that, I think, because what was happening in all these different places is that church leaders through Zoom or WebEx or whatever you're using were meeting together with their lay leaders and their officers and church councils and so on and saying, we're not really sure what to do. Anyone got any ideas? It was a real period of listening for many churches. I think it was a really healthy thing. We've learned something about different perspectives and hearing what others have got to say. So How to Lead Where You Don't Know Where You're Going is written by a lady in this country, Susan Beaumont, excellent book. Todd Bolsinger has written a book called Canoeing the Mountains, Christian Leadership in Uncharted Territory. The title comes from some pioneers that sought to canoe across the United States. And then they came to the mountains and realized that the mission was still the same, but the method had to change. And so that's what it's addressing. So I'll just say a few things about their observations, and then you say what you think. Let's have a discussion about it. So this is what Todd Bolsinger says. He says, adaptive leadership happens when these three things come together. Edwin Friedman, who's a Jewish rabbi and psychologist, written a number of books, and he's the one that originally coined the phrase, the non-anxious presence. He said this, not Todd Bolsinger, but Edwin Friedman, the Jewish rabbi. He said, we are in a time where we're suspicious of quick fixes and instant solutions that sweep through our culture, only to give way to the next fad. He argued for strength and self-differentiation as the marks of true leadership. His formula for success was more maturity, not more data, stamina, not technique, and personal responsibility rather than empathy. He said, we look for quick solutions for long-term problems due to a lack of emotional resilience. And so said that we're living in times that call for us to develop this non-anxious presence. He said, if someone smiles, we smile in response. If someone is angry, we don't have to be angry. We don't have to respond in like. Because maturity, emotional intelligence, enables us to defuse situations rather than add to them. We need to introduce a non-anxious presence, a leader who can be calm when all around is changing. My colleague James Lawrence says, probably what the world needs is not non-anxious presences, but perhaps slightly less anxious presences. Because actually, we're all anxious about stuff. It infects us all. But the question is whether that anxiety is tempered at all by our belief in a God of hope. A God, as Moltmann said, who meets us in the future, is already there, and therefore provides security as we head towards it. So what Todd Bolsinger's written is that three things help us to be good adaptive leaders. He said, firstly, we need the sort of technical competence in the basics of our work. He called it the stewardship of scripture and tradition, souls and communities, teams and tasks. You know, the basic stuff we take seriously and we do it as well as we can. I remember somebody in the lockdown saying to me, it feels like at the moment all I think about is worship, mission, and discipleship. And it's very refreshing. He said, all the other committees don't seem to be meeting. But I'm thinking, how do we gather in worship? How do I help people who are struggling with life? And how do we see our way through to being a missional community? He said that technical competence, I mean, just the ability to preach a good sermon or do a good visit, lead a good meeting, ask the right questions, the ability to do those basics of ministry, that's where we earn credibility. And he said, the thing about technical competence, he's American, so he uses, you know, sort of funny phrases, doesn't he? Apologies. He says that technical competence with relational congruence, I would call that emotional intelligence, I suppose, but the ability to connect, if you can do things reasonably well and work on how you connect with other people, those two things are the foundations, really, for developing adaptive leadership and so on. When I was archdeacon, I had a vicar in my area who, after he'd led the service, he'd say the blessing and then he'd walk out a side door and go home and never stayed to. You've probably felt like doing. I've certainly felt like doing that. especially when you preached a really terrible sermon, or you know. But he always did that because actually he really struggled with this kind of relational congruence thing, the kind of emotional intelligence, and actually he went on a journey where he had to learn. He had to learn how to connect better because the practice around avoiding people was undermining the good stuff that he was doing. And that, this is just Todd Bolsinger saying, if we try and do things well, if we try and connect well with people, that's all good stuff. I was interviewing a bloke who's in his 60s for a parish a few weeks ago. We said, tell us about something you've learned in recent years. And he said, I realize that I struggle to work with millennials. You know, those who were born, you know what I mean by that. And he said, and he described how he was struggling to work with millennials. And he said, and then I realized it was my problem. So I paid for some coaching to help me understand what life looks like. And he was just recognizing that his relational congruence, in Todd's language, with that particular age group was struggling. So what can I do to grow in my understanding? He said it was really, really helpful. But having technical competence and relational congruence, Bolsinger says, creates the environment in which we can develop our adaptive capacity. We become transformational through bringing together adaptive capacity with, you know, reasonable competence at the stuff that we do and a growing ability to relate well to people. And so he said that adaptive capacity is expressed in times of change in six different ways. So I'll give you these and see what you think, see if you agree or not. He said these are the areas. He said adaptive capacity is developed when we name some of the systemic issues and we show that we're keen to address them. We name some of the systemic issues and we show that we're willing to try and address them. I mean, I think in the English church, clericalism is still one of those systemic issues whereby we talk about setting God's people free, mobilizing a million and all the rest of it, but there's still a kind of holding on to that kind of special role that we have as clergy. I think the current state of our youth work is one of the systemic issues. And part of the role of leadership is to name reality and draw people into conversations about what are we going to do about those realities. That's the first thing. The second thing he said, and this is the non-anxious presence thing from Friedman, is that if we're keen to develop adaptive capacity, we want to develop the ability to calmly confront the unknown. And there are lots of unknowns at the moment. And, this is a principle he's inviting us to walk towards. I had some, just after I became responsible for CPAS, I had some chest pains. And I actually went into hospital three times. And the first couple of times, I couldn't see beyond, I've got chest pains and I'm about to die. You know, that was as far as I could see. But I noticed the third time that I went in, I became aware of some of the other people that are around me that were in a worse state than me. And I actually thought, I think I might just have a bit of a chat with them all and find out how they are. You know, we're not always calm, are we? You know, calmness is something we grow into the face of uncertainty. But I think adaptive leadership is saying, that is a journey I want to take because this is not just about me. It's about the people who are around me and serving them well. The third thing he talked about is leading a learning process, and I've sort of alluded to that in the comment about the larger church leaders. If we're heroic individuals, we want to come up with a solution and say, well, there's not many young people in the church, therefore I've got a plan. Bolzinger is saying that in uncertain times, we are pushed towards leading a learning process. So let's get together some teachers and some parents and some people who care about youth work. And rather than hoping that as a heroic leader, I'm going to come up with a quick fix, let's try and understand why it is that young people aren't connected with church. Let's try and work out in what ways they are connecting. What connections have we got through the local schools? What resources are available to us? So rather than thinking in your study, what am I going to do about this thing that I'm not sure what to do with? It invites us to say, I don't know what to do, so let's get a group of people in a room and ask. I forget who it was, who was a minister in the States who was asked by an actor. An actor said to him, what should we think about method acting? I think it might have been Tim Keller. And Tim Keller said, I don't know what method acting is. And they said, well, when you're acting, if you're acting angry, producers will say to us these days, don't act angry, get angry. You know, get in touch with something in you that you're angry about and express anger on the screen. So don't act angry, be angry. And they said to Tim Keller, as Christians, what should we think about that? And he said, I've got no idea. No idea what you should think about that. Let's get some actors together. And let's get a theologian in the mix. Let's have a conversation, see where it goes. I found that really helpful. And over the years, I've got head teachers together and policemen together and people involved in the justice session and people involved in helping prostitutes get off the street and all that kind of stuff. And said, I don't know what the solution is, but can we have a conversation and maybe an ongoing conversation about a sensible, possibly workable response to this thing, which I don't feel calm about, but I feel like we should be addressing. Does that make sense? Okay, good. So far, so good. And then three more things. He said, we should also be committed to personal transformation. That's what I heard from the vicar who got coaching from someone about how to relate to millennials. I know he's in his 60s. He's not saying, well, they should be like me. He's saying, how do I reach them? We committed ourselves to learning. The fifth thing that he talked about, I've put the example there, I didn't mean to do that, is courage in the face of resistance. He said, in community life, whenever you're thinking about something that's going to lead to change, you will experience resistance. And he said, welcome that as a friend. Because it's when you feel resistance, you realize that you're moving somewhere. You know, those of you that ride motorbikes will know that. You know, as you go faster and faster, your riding position changes because the resistance is having a different impact on you. And in a sense, you lean into the resistance of the headwind in order to make progress. And some of us struggle with that. That's the point at which we want to give up. Because somebody said, I had a bloke called Keith in my congregation. We were very, very good friends. He took me gliding on one occasion. But he was the classic traditionalist. He said to me, he was the guy that would, you know, I've seen a lot of changes over the last years and I've opposed every one of them. And I would say to Ralph, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? And he would say, you know what I think, Graham. We don't need to do it. There are people that help you know when you're moving forward and you feel the resistance. And then the final thing he said is that adaptive leadership requires a deep, deep faith in God. Somebody sent me yesterday a message. This is something written by Matthew Paris, who's in Friends. Is that right? Is that the right name? Perry. Matthew Perry, that's right. Matthew Paris, he's the writer in the Times, isn't he? And he was talking about his experience of addiction. And in the world of eating disorders, we have a lot about addictive practice. He said, I've had decades of struggling with God and wrestling with life and sadness. All of it was being washed away as I encountered God. And he talked about the experience. Like a river of pain gone into oblivion, I've been in the presence of God, I was certain of it, And this time I had prayed for the right things. I had prayed for help. And then he goes on to describe how his encounter with God had brought amazing transformation. I need these stories, not just from people on the telly, but from people around me. A young girl called Hannah was being baptized in a church I was in a few weeks ago. She'd been battling with an eating disorder. She'd nearly killed herself. And she talked about the transforming work of grace that changed her heart, reshaped her mind, brought her to a place of healing. Bless her heart, she's now training as a medic at Exeter University. I need to be reminded that although the church isn't growing by the million week by week, God is still at work in people's lives, doing the things that only God can do. Deep faith in God. So does that little kind of review of this adaptive leadership, does it ring bells with you? Does it terrify you? Or does it make you think, yeah, I see some of that? What do you think? Let's have some reactions. I don't mind what you say. I didn't write this. I mean, I've presented it, you know, but I think there's some sense in it. But tell me what you think. Go ahead, yeah. Use the microphone and then it's we can hear you.
It seems sensible. I mean, any fairly brief summary is always, there's always other things you could add, but I think it seems like a really good pattern to have in mind. And I suppose reflecting on it, I guess breaking it down into enough elements to be really clearly see them without too much is helpful, and it perhaps helps us see the where we have strengths and weaknesses. So looking at that, I think my biggest weakness within that system would be the leading a learning process. It's not that I'm sort of desperate to be the sort of vote leader, probably more just being kind of an introvert, sort of, I'm like, you know, INTP in my head kind of person. I just tend to think things through by myself. And so I think, yeah, I can think of ways in which I've done the other things in relation to church life. And that's been sort of, I think one occasion I have sort of led the learning process, and I think I can see where that was helpful, and other areas where I haven't. And so it's been helpful for me to sort of see that put out in those just bullet points, because it's allowed me to do have that mirror to myself and hopefully think, that's perhaps the point where I most need to work on and grow. So yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
I mean, it might even be that leading's the wrong word. It might be facilitating or initiating. It might be that somebody else is good at leading learning processes, and so, you know, there's a natural partner that you might work with. But thank you for that observation. Anything else? Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things that I notice in my work in the NHS, but also from previous experience, and anybody who's ever been in the military will understand this one, the five Ps: proper planning prevents poor performance. And also the fact that actually when you look at the very successful teams, especially in the military, people like the SAS and stuff, they accept the fact that they are a team and you are all together in this. And you, whilst you might be the expert in explosives or you might be the expert in sniping or whatever, you rely on the other people in your team to be with you, to be going with you. And that's one of the things I found, especially working in the NHS, is yes, you can lead a team, but you have to be with them, you have to bring them. It's having that sort of incarnational leadership, for want of a better phrase, where you're actually being with them and you collaborate with them, Grendel together, and then we go together, and then you then reassess the situation and say, did that work? Yeah, that bit did, that bit didn't. Right, so we change that bit.
Yes.
And that's where the adaptive comes. And it's like a cycle of of planning and assessing, checking, reassessing, replanning, rechecking, going round and round, but you're still journeying forward.
That's really helpful. I mean, absolutely, that you start on a journey and you can't always define the end, and the journey helps you to discover perhaps something that you didn't see originally. Somebody else was talking about the military earlier, and I've got a member of my team, Charles Burgess, who was one of the senior engineers on the Eurofighter project. He worked for the RAF, well, he was an RAF officer. And he said a lot of people's perception is that the military is people barking orders. And he said it's so far from that truth. He said nothing is done except in teams. And he said he felt quite shocked when he began to train for ordination and began to work with the Church of England. He said, I assumed that the team mentality would be thoroughly embedded in the church. But he said, I feel like we're quite a long way behind some other organisations. And of course, that's to do with our history and our heritage. But thank you. Thank you. Any other? Please.
I know that you've written commitment to personal transformation. That's any personal transformation. But I really like your example, because what I've realised is that generations are very, very different. And actually learning a bit about generations myself, I come from the Gen X, which is like that whatever generation. But I know my friends who were born in the boomer thing, they like a telephone call. But people today would rather WhatsApp and things like that. And literally just practically knowing the differences, how people's working patterns today are much different to the way we were brought up with our working patterns and things. So that's really good, I think.
I mean, it's a real generalisation, but you know, the traditionalists say, tell me what you want. The baby boomers, it's, are you qualified to tell me that? Gen X generally are saying, explain why it makes sense. Gen Y are probably saying, explain why it matters to you. You know, where's the heart in it? Gen Z, there's a lot of research going on there, but it's all generalisation, I know. And then we try and communicate with everyone and get lost. And still everybody says, I didn't know that was happening. Could I just finish with one little thing? I noticed quite a lot came up yesterday afternoon about managing expectations. I just wanted to show you something that some people find helpful in terms of managing expectations. It may be helpful to you or not. But one of the things that I've sometimes done where people are feeling weighed down by expectations is drawn something like this. Quadrants are always useful, aren't they? But the thing about expectations is that some are appropriate and some are inappropriate. So if you expect me to preach and I'm your church leader, well, that is an appropriate expectation. It comes with the territory. If you expect me to be at absolutely everything, that's probably inappropriate. If you expect me to connect with everything, that might be appropriate. But one of the and some of the expectations weigh heavily upon us, and some of them are light. So if you're asked to go and judge the Easter bonnet activity at the primary school, some people might think that's light, but absolutely not. You know, that is way up there. This is just a little tip, really. I'm not going to go into great detail, but one of the things that sometimes people find helpful is if you draw something like that and then write down a list of expectations that you feel you're living under, and then put each one on a post-it. So people expect me to be at every event. That is an inappropriate expectation, and that weighs quite heavily on me because so many people say it. The expectation to be holy, well, I think that's probably appropriate, but I don't quite know what that means. So if you build up a picture of the expectations that you live under, some of you are thinking this doesn't make sense at all, but if you live with a lot of expectations, you might find it helpful. If you can just sort out all the different expectations that you've got, which ones are appropriate, which ones weigh heavily, which ones are light, there are things that you can do about that. I mean, the ones that are inappropriate and weigh heavily upon you, Those are the big ones. Those are the ones that you need to sort of manage and work out, what do I do about those? I've been a school governor for 16 years and I wanted to stab myself in the eyes every time we had a governor meeting after that period, because we had yet another iteration from the government and I couldn't bear it. You know, and that would have come in that square at that time. And I asked somebody else to cover for me for 2 years and then I went back to it. Really helped, you know. But what about these? The ones that are light and appropriate, well, enjoy those, because they're probably part of why you took the job. You know, the ones that are the expectations, the ones that are heavy, you might need a bit of training to work out how to manage those a bit better. And the ones that are light and inappropriate, well, you can let some of those go. Now, the reason I do it is not because I know the answer to your expectations, but sometimes people find it difficult to work out how to manage them. Another tip is, if you find that all of your post-its are up here, then probably your morale is quite low, because everything is weighing on you. And if they're all up there, but anyway, I just offer it to you as a suggestion. If you find yourself wrestling with multiple conflicting expectations, it might just be a way of sorting them out and talking to your, talking to your supervisor or a friend or somebody, help me make sense of this. Put family stuff in, put work stuff in, put anything you want to put in, but it's just a method, okay?